Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, here we are on Women's Finals Day at the Wimbledon Championships 2018. Myself, Catherine Whittaker, David Law soon to join. I am assured by David Law himself, but I have Charlie Eccleshare of The Telegraph alongside me. We have just been watching the women's final won by Angelique Kerber, 6-3, 6-3 over Serena Williams, her third Grand Slam title. And it's a great story, Charlie. I really think it's a brilliant story. It's just not the story that we were all preparing for, so it's kind of a weird one, isn't it?
Yeah, I think everyone, the crowd certainly came almost thinking it was going to be a procession. You know, this was this amazing comeback story from Serena, but actually it's a comeback story in a slightly different way, maybe in a slightly more nuanced way. But you know, Kerber, who had that Annus Mirabilis 2016, you know, she won those two Grand Slams, was the top player, and then faded. And I think we thought, oh well, maybe that was it for Kerber. You know, she just had a sort of weird anomalous year, but actually to then come back and what we've said before, that Kerber maybe is best under the radar and kind of, you know, a bit more in the background. Well, today on the biggest stage of all against the greatest player of all time, she's delivered that performance. So yeah, it was quite something.
It perhaps suited her that the story was all about Serena today. I don't know how much of the podcast you've been listening to of this fortnight, but we've got into surprisingly deep discussion about introverts and extroverts and what sort of personality types are suited to what. And maybe it suited her today for everyone's attention to be on Serena.
Yeah, I mean, the focus was 90-odd% on Williams going into it. I mean, that was the story that everyone had already written, I think. And that was why, for me, and I know you had a similar feeling, I just had this funny sense that Kerber was going to win today. It did feel like she was almost being too written off, and that, yeah, that might suit her. She could come in, no pressure, just go out swinging, and anything was a bonus.
The thing is, I'd love to be smuggity-smug-smug about the fact that I did, as you did, have a feeling that Kerber would win this. But I completely understand that feeling that Serena Williams overrides all logical instinct. I get that, you know. I get that all the people that predicting Serena to win had seen the same things on paper I'd seen, but just thought, you know, it's Serena.
Yeah.
It's Serena, and there's this incredible force. It's this incredible story. I've done that in the past. But the fact is, she hadn't been tested before today, really. With all due respect to Gerges, who was the first top 50 player that she'd played all tournament, Gerges didn't challenge her in the way that she could have or somebody else could have. She didn't take time away from her. She didn't make her move laterally. So I don't think we really had the true test before today of where Serena was at.
No, absolutely. And that's, I always, and I think maybe naively, it always really winds me up that players seem to be beaten before they step on court against Serena or Federer or Nadal. And obviously that's very easy for me to say from my vantage point. To actually be stood toe-to-toe with them and really believe in yourself is obviously incredibly difficult. But I had that same sense. I thought, if Kerber can actually go out and somehow trick herself into thinking, this is someone who has barely played this year. You know, I am in tip-top physical condition. I'm the most durable athlete on the tour. If I can really, you know, rationally turn this match into what it became, you know, longer rallies, I should win this match. And she was able, seemingly, to do that. She was able to make it that kind of match. You know, it was long rallies. It was moving Serena from side to side. Because that's the only time that Serena had looked uncomfortable all tournament, was when people did that.
I don't know about you, but I feel like a lot of people were expecting the Kerber wobble, the moment where, you know, exactly as you said, maybe she'd been able to convince herself of something, the moment that the doubts about that sort of self-hypnosis came in, and it just didn't. Because as much as we talk about tennis psychology, and it undoubtedly is this enormous facet to the game, and we'll talk about the Anderson Djokovic final that we've got to look forward to, because I think that'll be an incredibly big factor. For me, it just kind of came down today to who was playing the better tennis, actually.
Yeah, I think the only slight wobble Kerber had, not even really a wobble, but that last game, understandably, her arm looked like it weighed, I remember even Ivanišević saying my arm weighed maybe 50 pounds, you know, in his last game, and it looked...
We love Goran Ivanišević impressions on the tennis
David
podcast,
doing
surely.
It, had to try and upstage it. But it did look like that, you know, Kerber... It was a shame, actually, because she served, I think it was a 30-15 point, a serve so slow, and I was just waiting for the speed gun, but it was a let, so we didn't get to find it. I genuinely think it was under 60 miles an hour. It was like watching me serve. It was painful. But she managed to get through that. And but yeah, prior to that, you know, she only faced one break point, I think, all match. Generally very secure, because that was the worry before, was her serve just going to get pulverized by Serena?
But the thing is, I don't know if you heard the Mary Carrillo episode from a couple of days ago. She said she gave me the secrets to
yeah,
being a world number one.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of time. Just a matter of time. I'm on the right trajectory now. She gave the secrets, and one of them was, if you have a weakness, to be able to cover up your weakness. And that was what struck me about Kerber today. That serve is a weakness, particularly the second one. She defends it so well that it didn't appear to be one today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it was, I often in my head compare Kerber and Djokovic. I think they're quite similar in that way. And her anticipation was Djokovic-esque, because the way the ball was coming back at Serena so quickly, because what Djokovic does so well is he gets into position, he anticipates. And Kerber, her serves weren't great often, but she just seemed to be able to know exactly where Serena was going to put her return, so that she was then in a position to hit the next shot anyway. It was amazing to see it. And she does that thing where she gets so low, she's kind of down on her haunches, which is almost like a trademark Kerber shot. She did that a few times really effectively today.
Yeah, she has kind of trademarked that. I know Agnieszka Radwanska does it and has done it for a long time, but it's so different. I mean, you couldn't imagine two players of more different stature physically than Radwanska and Kerber. Like, the way Kerber does it is, it's purely due to, I mean, it's her quad strength, isn't it? I mean, Angelique Kerber's quads are a sight to behold. They are, I mean, let's, you know, preserve them in some kind of preserving fluid once she's gone.
The greatest quads of all time.
Yeah, frankly, yeah, because, I mean, getting low on the grass, it's a thing, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing. It makes me wonder how many, I mean, I know the counterbalance is that big serving serves you well at Wimbledon, but it's this kind of weird dichotomy of the big serve, which generally tends to come with height, versus the fact that a low centre of gravity actually is an incredible weapon on the grass.
Yeah, she does use that much better than anyone I've ever seen. And I guess that is how she's able to compensate for, as you say, grass. You'd think that lack of speed on the serve would be exposed, you know, more than any other surface. But she is able to almost get away with it. It is hiding the weakness. It's a really good way of looking at it.
We will talk about Serena, of course, because her losing is, let's be honest, as big a story as Kerber winning today. But what's your take on one of the themes of our tennis podcast throughout the fortnight of personality types? And, you know, it's sort of, she wants to win, winning suits her, but the things that come with winning don't suit her. And yes, she's a two-time champion already, now a three-time Grand Slam champion, but winning Wimbledon comes with something extra on top of what she's already experienced. And so it's kind of all going to come back at her again. You referenced at the start there this really fascinating trajectory she's been on. That awful 2017 she happened. Courtney Nguyen from the WTA recounts this incredible story of the end of 2017, I think, when she played in Zhuhai, and she just walked off the court in this completely unceremonious way, and that was sort of the most awful and fitting end to her 2017, that it just fizzled away and she couldn't wait to see the back of it. And yeah, what now? What's going to happen now for Angelique Kerber?
I think for these players, it's about managing, making the best of that bad situation. Now, Kerber is not going to be someone who wants to be doing tons of photo shoots and all that sort of thing. I think she has to make peace with the fact that that does come with the territory. You know, I was thinking this about someone like Sasha Zverev, who, you know, often in his press conferences, he's quite snarky about questions that kind of betray the fact that not every journalist here is going to be following him around the ATP Tour for 52 weeks a year, you know, and you just have to kind of accept that.
Yeah, if he gets asked a question he's been asked the week before, he's like, well, why don't you look at my transcript from last week?
Yeah.
It's like, well...
Exactly, you kind of just need to make peace with those things. I think, you know, Kerber as well, she became more guarded after those Grand Slam wins. You know, certainly in the press room she became less interesting, less sort of sparky than she'd been. You talked about it as well with Muguruza, you know, that she's sort of got this guard up a bit now. And it's just whether that's helpful, whether that's the best way of dealing with that, or whether that actually takes up more energy. I think, you know, Kerber just has to find a way of being able to do these things without it draining her, you know, and taking away... She has to look at it, look, that this is part and parcel of being a Wimbledon champion, but don't let that affect what I love doing, and that's playing tennis.
Billie Jean King on the BBC this week talked about... She's being drawn into a similar debate about personality types and whether it just doesn't suit some people to be number one. Now, I don't know quite what Kerber will rise to as a result of that. I mean, she's not going back to number one, but she's back to having the target on her back, crucially. And Billie Jean King talked about number one. She never saw number one as a defensive position, as a position to defend. She saw it as and it sounds so trite, doesn't it? But that's what separates the champions from the mere mortals. She talked about it as soon as she got there, she was like, well, how can I improve? How can I make myself better? How can I make myself a better number one? Rather than thinking, oh my God, how can I just stay here? It's not, you have to not see it as treading water. And maybe the experience of having been there before, being in this situation, but I don't know, maybe it's about experience, or maybe it's just about... It not suits. As an introvert, I am fascinated by what is to come for Angelique Kerber.
I think as well, it's a kind of, and again, it's sort of hackneyed phrase, but that winning mentality. And I remember Roy Keane, who obviously is on the extreme end of a winning mentality, and him talking about how when United won the Champions League in '99, him basically berating players for saying things like, "I don't care what happens for the rest of my career, you know, I've won the Champions League." He could not understand. He could not fathom that mindset. He was like, How can you not see this as a springboard? You know, and that is the difference between guys who will get to number one and then that's fine, and those who get to number one, like, yeah, okay, well, when's my next slam coming from? You know,
which probably brings us nicely on to Serena Williams,
yeah, in
doesn't
that category.
It? Now, the question I asked you before we started recording, which we decided to curtail the discussion for on air, was what will get more space in the Telegraph tomorrow? Kerber winning or Serena losing?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I mean, Serena is, for most of our readers, obviously the more recognisable personality. It's a story as well that's probably, for someone who maybe doesn't follow the tennis calendar all year round, a story that anyone can identify with. It's amazing, you know, someone has a baby, comes back, what an inspiration that is. So I think inevitably a lot of the attention will and has to focus on Serena, because she's the greatest tennis player of all time, you know, so that will have to be a big factor. But then, you know, of course, then the Kerber element comes into it as well. And I think, you know, the fact that they seem to get on, and, you know, there was those lovely images of them embracing. So, you know, I think hopefully it will mesh together quite nicely.
It's a funny one for Serena, isn't it? Because we all remember the Australian Open 2016. And that was, of course, Kerber's first Grand Slam. It was an absolute shock at the time that Kerber beat Serena in that final. And there was this almost, we all doubted, well, some of us, doubted the sincerity at the time of Serena's intense happiness for Kerber. She seemed like crazily happy for her opponent, for this diehard competitor to be so genuinely happy in the moment of defeat on the biggest stage was bizarre. And I think she felt that today. I do. I think she felt those same feelings, but there was also the moment that her voice broke when she was talking to Sue Barker, wasn't there? Yeah. There was just that flicker.
I think because she genuinely felt that she... You often hear it, don't you, with sports people, it's when they feel they've let people down, that's when they're most upset. And I think she so wanted to be this inspiration to mums everywhere that you could do that. You could take time out and then come back and be the Wimbledon champion.
Do you think Serena Williams today had a feeling of having let people down?
Well, as crazy as that sounds, you know, I think she just so wanted to have achieved this incredibly inspirational thing, which she has done anyway. You know, she knows she's given absolutely everything, but I think that's when her voice wavered, when she says, you know, I so wanted to do this for mums everywhere, and which I thought was just an amazing thing for her to say. But, you know, she knows that she has not let anyone down, and reaching the final is an unbelievable achievement.
What does David Law make of that unbelievable achievement? We're talking about whether Kerber winning or Serena losing is the bigger story, David. And yeah, I mean, Serena obviously hasn't let anybody down. For me, the Serena story works whether she won today or not.
Yeah, they're equally big for different reasons, really. I also equate a little bit Serena Williams's comeback to Novak Djokovic's. Different reasons, but you could see what it means to them to be back after a period away. And I do feel that Angelique Kerber, what an admirable performance and tournament she's had. I mean, she was just not having it. And we always felt, I thought, Serena's going to have to play her absolute best tennis to beat this one, because she's not going to let the ball pass. She just doesn't let you have it. And Serena was short today. I just would love to have seen a third set. I would love to have seen more, because I think that is one of those classic examples where Serena might have been able to just play her way in to that final, and she didn't get the chance. But, well, that's because Angelique Kerber was so damn good.
Is this a match, then? We often hear about how, oh, it's a shame that, you know, let's cut five setters to three setters. Is this a match where actually it would have been really interesting for it to be a best-of-five set match?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are other examples of it in the women's game from this fortnight. I think the one that stood out for us was Kerber and Ostapenko, where Ostapenko just about managed her challenge at the end, but it just came a little too late, and had there been a bit more time, that could have been so, so interesting. I think absolutely. It was interesting yesterday after the Anderson-Isner, I don't know, what are we calling it, ordeal? Epic, ordeal, thriller,
struggle,
classic, struggle, all those things. It was amazing how quickly everyone was pretty unanimous about the fact that something has to change here. I kind of feel the same today. I mean, I can't be unanimous on my own. But it seems clear to me. It just seems so clear to me, in the way that it suddenly seemed clear to everyone yesterday that something needs to change there. It seems equally clear to me today that something needs to change.
It just felt weird that after, what was it, 64 minutes, it was over. It felt like it just gone by in the blink of an eye. And I think especially when you've just come off 2 5-set marathons, it just jarred a little bit.
And the annoying thing is that then gets used as a stick to beat women's tennis with, and I hate that. Because you could use all sorts of other examples the other way, but you never dig them out until you're under attack, in a way, from a women's tennis perspective. Nobody ever sees a great 3-set match in a women's tournament and goes, oh, you know, see, all this rubbish about equal prize money, that's why we have it. It doesn't happen, but it does happen the other way around. And it would just be nice to remove that as an element of the conversation completely, because it shouldn't be there, and therefore you could get around it. Plus, you would remove this problem of somebody being out of form in a final and losing it quickly, or worse still, suffer from nerves. Obviously, that's not going to be the situation as much for someone like Serena Williams, but she couldn't deal with Angelique Kerber because Kerber was so good. But she might have been able to over time. Maybe she wouldn't, but at least give it a chance. And at the same time, if you could shorten matches on the men's side in the first week, you save them a bit more, and you add extra emphasis and importance on those last few rounds. Mm.
Okay, then, seeing as you sort of vaguely brought us onto this topic, David, how about the fact that... What time did the women's final start today?
I think it was about 3:45 or something like around there, maybe 4 o'clock. It was meant to start at 2 o'clock, wasn't it? No, it was 4:15 because they had a half an hour break between the two matches, which was a decision I thought was sensible, regardless of how long the men's match went, and it went long, so... They needed to be able to let people out and come back in again so that it wasn't a half full.
Yeah, under the circumstances, that was the right decision, I think. But they created the circumstances for that decision to be made. And what do we think about the fact that the women's final ended up being a not before time when, under repeated questioning fire about the men's final and the World Cup final, the clubs fell back on this trope of but the tradition of the final starting at 2 p.m. being this Rubicon that cannot be crossed.
I guess in their defence we would then be saying it would be incredibly... It's one thing to not move it for tradition's sake due to external forces like the World Cup, but when you're talking about actually the well-being of the players, they've made an exception, and I think we'd be saying it would be an incredibly pig-headed decision them not to have done it for that reason, if, as apparently was the case, the men's players said they wanted to go first so as to have a longer gap before the final.
Could they not have started at midday?
Possibly, but then you've got the issue where they finished at 11 p.m. last night. So then I think it was a difficult balancing act for them because they wanted to give them enough rest, having finished so late last night, but also then have enough rest for tomorrow's final.
I think those are very valid points. I just think that it's, from what I've gathered from various briefings that people have had with the referee's office, is that the men's players in this situation have been asked their opinions, their preferences about all the decisions at every turn. Would you like the roof to remain closed, Rafa Novak? Would you like to play before the women's final or after women's final? Were Serena and Angelique consulted about their feelings on any of this at any stage? I don't know. They might have been, but the sense I get is that they weren't.
Well, the answer is I don't know yet, and they haven't been into their press conference as we talk to you right now. One person I did speak to briefly was Kim Clijsters, who wasn't happy that the women's final had been moved and there wasn't a set time, felt that the ladies' singles final should have its place and its slot, and that should be that. I would ultimately, I think, go along with that. I do understand the reason, and it's a problem. It was a problem that if you have the men finishing their semi-final at 7 p.m. tonight and then trying to come out and play again at 2 o'clock tomorrow, that is a big ask, and physically that's a problem. I'd probably still have done it.
Would one option to be, why not say... If you're going to remove the sanctity of that 2 p.m. start time, which they effectively did today anyway, give a start time that's more realistic, like 4 o'clock. Because that way, that seems like a far more likely start time. Like, 2 p.m. today was never going to happen. You know,
I agree. The sanctity of there being a start time is more important than the sanctity of
exactly.
what that start time is.
Yeah, exactly. At least then the players have a... Because it should be about the players, and at least then Kerber and Williams can know, okay, 99% chance we're going to start at 4, or we're going to start at 5. Whereas today, what chance was there? 20?
Why not have a 12:30 and a 4 o'clock? I mean, I completely agree. But the fact is, we had...
We should
the
be in charge.
We've been saying this for 2 weeks, Shirley.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra.
and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The fact is, we had the resumption of Nadal and Djokovic, and look, nobody is resenting that tennis that we have seen today, and nobody on centre court was resenting it, nobody in the media was resenting it, nowhere, anywhere. It was sensational. It was absolutely sensational. It was won by Novak Djokovic, and very deservedly so, but that's not the whole story. I mean, there's so much to that story.
Yeah, I mean, Briggsy touched on it last night. It was the absence of a big four Grand Slam match. Then when you started watching it, you're like, yeah, this is amazing. Just what they bring. And I think especially, and no disrespect at all to Isner and Anderson, which was a really exciting match in its own right, but certainly the last set of that, just because of the nature of it, had become quite one-dimensional. To then see the layers and the thought processes and what they're doing and the variety was just so heartwarming and invigorating, well, I think.
I thought it was one of the best matches I've ever seen. And I'm always a bit wary of judging a match so soon afterwards, because you can get uplifted by the moment and overdo it, and I've done that before. But watching it last night and then watching it again today, the resumption, the type of points they were having, the lumps they were knocking out of each other, and as you say, not just hitting, the strategy, the knowing each other's patterns and trying to do something about it to knock the other one out of their stride, and the improvisation based on what somebody else had just done to you to try to turn the tables. And it was just repeated. It was swings. That set, that fourth set that I commentated on, there's a 15-minute first game. Mm. And it was eventually a hold of serve by Nadal, with Djokovic just piling on the pressure. And then Nadal streaks out to a 3-love advantage. And you're thinking, he's got him, he's going to race through this set and we're into a fifth. And Djokovic is just like, no, I'm not done yet. And he reels him back in for 3-all. And then they're going hammer and tongue. Nadal wins that set. And then the one of my favourite moments in the whole match was an exchange in the fifth set towards the end, when, first of all, Djokovic just won this crazy point when I think he was break point down, and Nadal just attacked him, just threw the whole kitchen sink. He was the Rottweiler, just jumping on him. And Djokovic still found a forehand cross-court passing shot to save break point, and then whipped his arms up and got the crowd up. And I loved that. And then a few points later, you've got, it was actually in the final game of the match, ultimately. I think Nadal is under massive pressure. I think he's 15-30 down, and he won a point that was so uplifting that he just put his arms in the air like he just scored the goal in the World Cup final. And he didn't fist pump, he just put his arms and celebrated it by putting his arms up, and the crowd just stood up. And I just laughed. The rally was so absurd. The corners they'd sent each other into, and it wasn't just hitting, it was short slices, and then set up your opportunity down the line. You've made that, and then digs it out with a little forehand chip, and then you're back into the rally, and then the other one turns the tables. I mean, it was just, I felt delirious watching it.
Is there an argument, say, and apologies if this is a really old thought, but that in pure tennis terms, that's the greatest rivalry than Nadal Djokovic, even more so than Nadal Federer? I mean, just what they've produced and how they bring out the best out of one another?
I think there's a strong argument for that. The argument in favour of the reason that we think Nadal Federer is so memorable is because they hold the record for Grand Slam meetings. Mm. It just so happens that so many of their meetings have come at slams, but Djokovic and the casual tennis observer mostly watches the slams. So you'd think Nadal Federer. I think for the nerdier tennis fan, Nadal Djokovic is the one.
Especially, and I just think, like, take away all... I mean, Nadal Federer is rivalry perfection in the, their personalities and everything like that. But yeah, just the way those two... I just love what they bring from one another. And it does make me... And I felt this when Djokovic came back during the clay court season, and again made me realise how much I'd missed him. Just the thought that's going on, and it does make me worry. Just, and hopefully they'll develop it over time. But just whether the younger players, maybe it is just a learning curve, but they don't play with that same texture and that same variety. It's just so much about power
or appetite.
Yeah,
that's
well,
the other
yeah.
thing. You know, look at these guys.
Every
look
point.
What they've already done. Look what they've put on the line. Where does it come from? Where does this desire to win? To compete, to know you're not having the bone. I'm having the bone.
Yeah.
A few people tweeted out that during last night and today about as talented as some of this next gen are, and there's plenty that we're beating the drum about and are excited about, but it made me realise how blooming far there is for them to go and how small a piece of the pie talent actually is.
And actually, if you look at their rivalry overall, which is now 27 Djokovic, 25 Nadal, the sort of rally that I've described about how they sort of wrestle control of a rally and then put the other one on the back foot and then the other one finds a solution and it just carries on. And they've rewritten my job as a ball-by-ball commentator because I think rallies are over and I've built to my crescendo. And then, oh my God, they're back into another baseline rally because the other one's defence is so good. But look at their...
find another octave.
Yeah, another octave, yeah.
yeah.
yeah. But the... If you look at the actual swings and roundabouts of their whole careers and the streaks they've each had, 11 out of 12 matches won by Djokovic in a three-year period between 2013 and 2016. And before that, there were swings when Nadal had the upper hand. And then there was that one in 2011 when Djokovic won about the first 40 matches of the year and Nadal couldn't deal with him.
I think it's the Nadal is the best thing that can happen to Djokovic, because I think sometimes Djokovic's matches can feel a bit attritional and quite grindy, but Nadal forces Djokovic to do so much more, and he brings out the aggressive side that is there in Djokovic.
And I think what you've just said applies in a micro and a macro sense, because I think winning that match over Nadal yesterday and today could be the best thing to happen to Djokovic in terms of his comeback. In general, I think he's the heavy favourite to win the final tomorrow, and I feel sad for Kevin Anderson saying
it could
that.
Be a good final. Don't forget, Anderson had him at 2 sets to love. Don't forget, 3 years ago on court one.
I hope I'm wrong, and if we were going into it, you know, slates completely clean, you know, 2 week holiday prior for both of them.
Let's do it in 2 weeks.
Yeah, then I'd be saying Djokovic is my favourite, but Anderson has a really good chance. But I know Djokovic has played a lot of tennis. I know he's not had a rest day in the way that Anderson has, but I interviewed Anderson earlier and he didn't seem to be having a rest day. He seemed to be having a slightly painful day. I desperately hope he can mount a challenge, but all logic is telling me he probably can't. Look, the fact that it went long today helps him a bit. It does. It helps him.
I think it will be marginally less close than what you've described in terms of what you would have hoped it might have been had everything else been equal. I think Anderson's got a chance. I really do. I don't think he'll win, but I think he can. I don't think it will be a walk in the park.
I hope so. I think the potentially. I mean, you're looking basically at the differentials, aren't you, of what they've been through? And one thing I would say is that not only does Djokovic have doesn't have the rest day, his match was a lot more intense. I do think that last set for Anderson, he obviously was giving absolutely everything into it, but it didn't have quite the same intensity of Djokovic's match. I do kind of agree with Catherine. I think if I were putting a bet on it, I would say Djokovic in straight sets.
Grumpy so-and-so. It's honestly, glass is half empty.
What I'll say about the interview I did with him earlier, and he was delightful. He was absolutely delightful. He's a lovely man. He really is. And he gave us time. He was an hour and 20 minutes late because he was watching the end of the Nadal-Djokovic match, but I will forgive him that. He wasn't relaxed. He wasn't relaxed, and I would have thought the only benefit to having gone through what he went through yesterday would be for him to say to himself, well, everyone's not giving me any chance. I've been through that. That's the battle. Everything from now on is a bonus. I've just got to go out there and hit and see what happens. He didn't seem to have that relaxation.
But he's not a relaxed character.
No, he's not. He's not. Maybe there are no circumstances in which he would feel that before a Grand Slam final. You're quite right.
I was saying in a piece this week, he has that look of a man who's kind of constantly worried he might have left the iron on or something. He's just kind of got that like preoccupied vibe.
I might have done that.
Do you think he might be an introvert?
I think he could well be. I think he very much is. I mean, he was practicing his fist pumps and come on shouts in the mirror, wasn't he?
I spoke to his sort of life coach just now, leadership consultant, Alistair McCaw, I think it was.
Do we all have one of those?
Yeah, and he was
a
telling
leadership
me...
leadership consultant.
Something like that, yeah.
And did he give you his business card?
No, I feel like I'm well stocked in that sort of way. You know, I was quite uplifted by the end of it. But what he was saying is just how coachable Kevin Anderson is, that he's just quite happy to be told what to do and pull me up if I'm not doing it.
It's funny you should say that, because we had a slightly bizarre situation in this interview where we wanted him to do it down the barrel, looking at the camera. So I was interviewing him, but he had to give all his answers not looking at me, looking at the camera, which is a really, really bizarre dynamic for an interview. And I sort of explained that plan to him really apologetically in advance, like, oh, I know this is a bit awkward, Kev, but, you know. And he was like a schoolboy. He was like, yeah, I can do this. I'll do my
best.
I'll do my
best.
And he did so well, and you could see how hard he was trying with it. And then about four answers in, he lost himself for a moment. He looked over at me mid-answering and went, oh, I'm so sorry. I'll do it again. And I was like, it's fine. This whole thing's going to be edited and painted. And, you know, we're not going to run it as a 15-minute long, you know, it's fine. But that was exactly the thing that struck me, you know, how willing he is as a learner, how much of a sponge he is. It was sweet and endearing and... it was lovely.
And given all that, I mean, we were talking before about Kerber and how she dealt with being a Grand Slam champion. I mean, how would big serving Kevin Anderson deal with being a Grand Slam champion, being a Wimbledon champion?
I think he would love it in the short term. I think the one thing is whether he would be prepared to change at all. And I think the key almost is for somebody to accept. If you're not the type, don't try to be the type.
Yeah, that's what we were saying earlier.
Because that's Angelique. I remember seeing her at the WTA finals at the end of 2016 after that incredible run, and she was so charming, and she did all our interviews and so forth. But I got the sense that she was trying to play the part of the world number one. She was trying her best to do what you do, you know, and it just wasn't her. It seems like she's sort of figured it all out a bit now, that she doesn't have to do that.
Yeah, do a Sinatra, do it your way.
Yeah, there you go.
But that's what I think about Novak Djokovic. I think he has, for so long, he's had this difficult thing, not being Federer, not being Nadal, and almost tried to be them for a while. And I think he's so much better when he's being himself, he's being defiant, he's being a bit punkish. That's great. You know, it's a point of differentiation apart from anything else. But, you know, just that's what fans want, I think. They just want to see someone being genuine and being true to themselves.
I completely agree. And he was today, wasn't he? I loved that sort of trying to fire the crowd up. Yeah, get behind me. I'm playing brilliant tennis right now.
How about when he slammed the racket into the sole of his shoe? Very nearly caused himself an injury there. Because if he'd have missed his sole of his shoe, he'd have broken his ankle, the violence with which he was doing it.
Gents, we need predictions.
I'll go for Djokovic in four.
Djokovic in three for me.
Ooh, Djokovic in four. I think he's going to have a mental wobble.
I convinced you.
I think he's going to have a mental wobble. And I think, Djokovic in four.
Who's going to win? Is Jamie Murray and Victoria Azarenka going to win the mixed doubles? And is Jack Draper going to win the boys?
Jack Draper plays the top seed, I think, Jason Tseng, Chinese Taipei. So I think that's a tough ask on any day. it's a particularly tough ask after a 90. He's effectively played his first ever five-set match and then some. And the fact that he's come through it at the age of 16 is extraordinary, and there's so much to take from that. I think, on balance, this will probably be a bridge too far for Jack Draper. I think Muzarenka will do it, though.
Muzarenka, yeah. And
No, I'd agree with both of those. I think Muzarenka will win, and yeah, I think for Draper, it's one thing you look at these top guys, you know, we talk about Anderson, Djokovic, how can they recover, but at least they've got some experience of doing that before. Draper obviously doesn't. I think it'll be too much of an ask for him.
I'm going Draper. I don't care what you
really?
Say. Yeah, I mean, I've got no grounds for that, but I'm just, you know,
be contrary.
It's coming home. But just a quick mention as well of victory today in the wheelchair doubles for Gordon Reid and Alfie Hewitt. Third in a row.
They're so great, aren't they? Are there two more endearing men in tennis? I'm not so sure.
And Andy Lapthorne today as well in the first ever quad wheelchair doubles.
Yeah, first ever. That's a big deal for Wimbledon, actually, and it is shame on us that we haven't mentioned the fact that they've had quad wheelchair doubles
for
the first time. Yeah, but we're mentioning it now. I know that's something that Andy Lapthorne and the rest of the quad wheelchair players have been campaigning for a long time. And for them, it's a huge deal. It's an absolutely monumental thing to be playing here at Wimbledon. I'd love to see them get bigger courts. I know that the argument against that is the damage it does to the courts, but particularly this year where the courts are so hard. They're basically hard courts. I mean, you could steamroller over them and I'm not sure it'd do that much damage. They're concrete, basically.
Well, look, Wim Fissette's over there, coach of Angelique Kerber, holding court with about seven of the Germans.
He's coached an awful lot of players to victories over Serena Williams. That's one thing that Charlie and I didn't discuss. But what is Azarenka, Clijsters, Lisicki here in 2013? I'm loath to attribute female achievements to men, but it has to be said that a doff of the cap is probably merited.
Also, just a penny for Joe Konta's thoughts on that. I mean, I know, you know, every combination is different, but was she a little hasty maybe in getting rid of him at the back end of last year?
Absolutely.
Maybe I could sign him up for me against you. You know, just once, like almost charity thing.
You've got the leadership consultant.
I don't think he's a guy right now that's looking for work. There's certainly not pro bono work.
All right,
that's not the vibe I'm getting from him.
Should we go home now?
Yeah, we've been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, with Charlie Eccleshare from The Telegraph. Thank you very much, Charlie. With Amazon Prime Video UK, the home of the US Open in the UK. With our executive producers, Triple S, Melanie Bowes and TennisBalls.com. With La Manga Club, and with Charlie the Ferret as well. And we will be back for one last daily Wimbledon tennis podcast tomorrow on men's finals day. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.